that numerator is what you would get if you had isolated lines, you know, so the particles just come in and nip, right? So you have the same initial and final momenta, which we threw out. It's probably just the stuff we threw out. So if you have a if you have a diagram where, you know, P1 goes to K1, say, and P2 goes to K2, you know, you can add loops over here where you create something and annihilate it, or, you know, if we've got lambda 5 and the 4th, what would it take? A couple of these, so, you know, something like that would be allowed in this diagram. Well, we threw out this part, so we don't see those contributions to it. But those factors would exactly cancel that denominator. So the contribution from that. Okay. And then this doesn't give any contribution, and you're adding it all to those. I think that's basically what's going on. That's how we had some stranger in the class just working back there. Didn't recognize you. That's cool. Oh. You know, that's what I would look like if I didn't use this special shampoo after I swim. And the chlorine would do that to my hair.
Yeah. Yellow white it?
Yeah, it can, well, it acts as kind of a chartreuse. Yeah. Not quite blonde, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
I was going for platinum. It didn't work.
Oh. It's kind of gold, you know?
Like, yeah, there's a lot more orange in here. But it's not a big deal. I just kind of did it for kicks and giggles anyway.
Cool. Orange is good. Maybe we should make it a requirement that everybody come to class with a different color of hair every week.
Why not?
Yeah. Okay. So, we're good on that paragraph. Are there any other questions in essence? So, back to loops and divergence. Let me rewrite the expression that we the last correct expression we wrote last time, and then we'll integrate it correctly this time. We did work through it, and it's just fine. So I don't know what we were doing. Yeah, maybe that's a sign that it's time to quit, you know, when I start making mistakes. And, okay, so we had last time. So what was it? This was something, I forget what, is equal to minus I lambda squared and a half. And then we had all of these propagators. And we were left with a pair of integrals times d4x prime. Easy I P1 plus P2 X minus I K1 plus K2 X prime. And then we had two of these D guys, X minus X prime squared. So we wanted to do this, these last mini integrals. Yeah.
Is that right? Six different momenta out there, though. I think just we have just the way you wrote it. There's P1 through P4, but P1, P2, and K1.
Oh, yeah, I see. No, weren't you here when we did the six particles?
I missed that one.
K1, K. Good. All right, markers. that. Okay, and then these things are integral. What are they? D4. Let's call it T1 and T2 over 2 pi to the fourth. And then we have the propagator. That's right. So Q1 squared minus M squared E to the minus I Q X minus X prime. Q1. Is that right? Is that the form of our D?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so just the Fourier transform of I over Q squared minus M squared. So, let's see, minus I lambda squared over 2. We have the product of the D tildes of the momenta. All four of them. And then, let's see, these integrals, let's write them separately. D4x and let's see, we're going to have e to the I t1 plus t2 x, and then there's the next here, and we'll call this other one q2. So we're going to have minus q1 minus q2 x, and let's see, that's all the x stuff. And then we have the other integral d4 x prime e to the I. Now we have minus I K1 plus K2. And the X primes, well, they come in with the opposite sign too, so we still have minus Q1 minus Q2 here with an X prime. And then the propagators, we're going to have an I squared over 2 pi to the 8. Q1 squared minus M squared. Q2 squared minus M squared. Good. And these give delta functions. We also have the momentum integrals. D4 Q1 D4 Q2. There we go. So minus I lambda squared, quantity squared over 2. Product of momentum propagators. Then, this is going to give 2 pi to the 4th times the delta in that combination of momenta. Same here, it's going to cancel these 2 pi factors to the 8. So, we're going to have integral d4 q1 d4 q2 del 4 of p1 plus p2 minus q1 minus q2 del 4 of k1 plus k2 minus q1 minus q2. And then just the propagator term. So now we integrate over, let's say, Q2. So we're going to do this integral, and it's going to set, we can choose either of these, so we can set Q2 equal to what? K1 plus K2 minus Q1. So we do that. We're left with D4 Q1
this what we got yesterday?
Oh, no, yeah, this is good. Del 4 of P1 plus P2. Let's see. So Q2 is replaced by K1 plus K2 minus Q1. And that gives a plus Q1 minus Q1, so that Q1 is going to cancel out. And this gives our overall conservation of momentum delta function. Good. And then, all we have left are these two propagators. Well, one of these is the propagator in momentum space for Q1, and the other is the propagator in momentum space for Q2 is K1 plus K2 minus Q1. Notice that because momentum is conserved, this could just as well have been P1 plus P2 here. So it could have been either one, but the final result, let's just for computing, it was not actually equal to anything. This is our stuff times IT, right? So this stuff is going to cancel this stuff, and this is called stuff, and those cancel. So seems like we're missing a 2 pi to the 4th somewhere. Did we lose the 2 pi to the 4th?
Yeah.
Where?
There's two pi to the 8th
mm-hmm.
the denominator.
But then each of these delta functions gives us a 2 pi to the 4th. So those cancel. I don't see. Seems like we should have a 2 pi to the 4th still somewhere. Let's not carry over that. So basically our IT expectation is going to be minus I lambda squared over 2. So a combinatoric and a coupling constant. The product of those propagators vanishes. We have our del 4. Surely there's supposed to be a 2 pi to the 4th in there. I'm just going to put it in because I know it's supposed to be there, but I don't know where we lost it. Then the delta function in momentum. And then an integral. An integral d4 q over 2 pi to the 4th, there it is, times a pair of propagators, d tilde of q, d tilde of, let me call it p1 plus p2 minus q. Recall in our loop we've got p1 and p2 coming in, then, let's see, what did they do? They join it at a vertex.
P2 and P2.
And departed the second vertex. So the idea is if Q goes out here, then we better have P1 plus P2 minus Q going out there. So then there's a total momentum anywhere of P1 plus P2. And overall conservation means P1 plus P2 will equal K1 plus K2.
Should there be a P1 somewhere on the bottom?
Yes.
Oh. In the picture, it might be confusing.
Yeah.
P2,
P1. P1 and P2 were close to begin with.
Does that ever seem to get a sign difference? From what we've got, what we started with yesterday.
Oh,
we had K1 plus K2 minus P1 plus P2.
Oh, and the delta function. No, that doesn't matter.
It doesn't.
That's symmetric. I think we were calling these K and those P last time. Is that right?
Oh,
So, yeah, you can write, delta functions are symmetric in the argument. So delta of x and delta of minus x are the same thing.
So yeah. that's
it. It actually switches. In the section loops and divergences,
yeah.
You have p's going in and k's coming out, and in every section before that, k's going in and p's coming out.
So we'll understand.
I like to bring p's in and k's out.
That's what he's doing now, so.
Okay. All right.
And I said yesterday, I was like,
let's see. So, yeah, let me refresh myself. Okay, there are two other graphs, right? This Feynman graph, we also had the possibility of. You can have a loop going this way. So you've got a P1, K1, and over here a P2, K2. Or you can cross those. So you have P1, K2 out. Over here you have P2, K1 out. So now we go back and we do two more similar calculations and get very similar results. And then we've done the second order terms. I think we've got all the diagrams here. So for this particular kind of interaction. So we get a new Feynman rule in momentum space. So talking about in momentum space, we're talking about all the momentum stuff that occurs. So the two positive force we knew about, the delta function we knew about, the coupling constant we knew about, a combinatoric factor we knew about. The thing that's new is this integral. So here's the rule. Associate a propagator to each internal line in a loop. That's an internal line. This is an internal line. This one. So we're going to stick two propagators in here. Use momentum conservation at the vertices to reduce the number of independent momenta and integrate over the remaining unfixed momenta with the measure d4k over 2 pi to the 4. So there's our measure. So this is the rule. This is what happens. If you've got a loop, any undetermined internal momenta in your diagram, you insert an integration, and you insert the corresponding propagators for all the undetermined lines. So, now we have to do an integral, some more integral, to figure out what we get. Okay, then, it's not hard to see what the other ones are. Let's see. How are we writing this? Let's go ahead and note this. Let A of T be defined as this thing. So it's just probably all of that, right? Yeah. Lambda squared over 2. Not the 2 pi, the delta function, just the d4q 2 pi to the 4th. But then d tilde of q, d tilde of, let's just call this t minus q, like that. So then the three diagrams. Okay, what we have here is what comes in here is P1 plus P2. Okay, what comes in here going in is P1 minus K1. And what comes in here is P1 minus K2. So, with this definition, the second order contributions ought to be A of P1 plus P2 plus A of P1 minus K1 and A of P1 minus K2, plus against, right? At lowest order, we got an I lambda. So the total scattering matrix, remember, this is 2 pi to the fourth, the del 4 at the sum of the momenta, times M, initial goes to final. So this scattering matrix is given by that expression.
So those are the three diagrams. Did I get it right?
P1 minus K1, P1 minus K2. Cool.
There's
a minus I here. That's what we had at first order in lambda. These are all second order in lambda. So this is the first two orders in perturbation theory. Okay, so this is all really cool. So now let's do this integral. Blows up. This last integral here is infinite.
I got it.
Which is sad when you've done so much work to, for scattering amplitude and stuff, you find that you've just computed an infinite quantity. And, people want to predict something from this theory, so you press on. I'm going to show exactly the form of the infinities here. The simplest thing you can do is put a cutoff on the integral that keeps it from diverging.
How did it blow up in the first place?
I'm going to show this.
Oh, okay.
Let's just write it down. So we've got the integral is d4k over 2 pi to the 4th. And then we've got I over have I got K and K? Oh, Q. Okay. I've suddenly changed to K here. Let's stick with Q. And then this one is let's just compute A of P. So we've got this silly coefficient, but that's not too much to worry about. And then we have P minus Q. Is it that squared minus M squared? Is that what we get?
It's not just the difference of squares, right? It's that whole thing squared. Yeah, right. Okay.
Now, this isn't too bad. You sort of wonder what happens when Q squared equals M squared. You've got some simple poles in the complex plane. We actually handled those with the propagators. Those come out okay, I think. But the thing that causes problems here. The divergence as Q goes to infinity. All right, now remember Q is a momentum or a wave vector. So we're talking as Q goes to infinity, 2 pi over lambda, the wavelength is going to small wavelengths, the frequencies are going high. So this is called an ultraviolet divergence, a high-frequency divergence. So they talk about whether theories are UV finite or UV divergent. That's ultraviolet. That's a divergence at the high-energy end of the spectrum. So you see what's happening here is that you can have any momentum running around this loop in addition to, what you're conserving through the loop. And as you add up all those contributions, giving a non-convergent result. We will systematically, there are probably half a dozen ways to extract correct information from these theories that all make the same prediction. There's dimensional regularization. There's a cutoff that we'll use here. There's, BRST operators. You have this thing that squares to zero, and you use that in a fancy way. There's renormalization groups, or just renormalization or renormalization groups that say dimensional. Dimensional regularization, where you let the dimension be anything other than 4 and this converges. So that's what you do. You let the dimension be 4 plus epsilon. And you figure out how to do something like that. You define what that means. You do everything, and then you take epsilon to 0, and that works. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that do systematically remove this problem. But let's now look at the problem. I say all that because people worry about this a lot. Your predictions are infinite, and you've got the smell throughout these infinities. Well, the point is they're being thrown out in a very systematic, careful way, and in enough different ways you eliminate the singular behavior that you're confident that the predictions you're getting from the finite piece is really a prediction. It's really some reproducible calculational thing that then does agree with experiments. So you get a feeling that we're actually doing things right here, even though it looks a little bizarre at this stage. So here's what happens. Since we're taking 2 to 0, or to infinity, let's drop t. Alright, so q is much bigger than t, so this is about going to be q squared, and we just have this factor twice. So then, call it a of 0 then. We'll see the divergent behavior. The finite part we're not worried about right now. We just want to see what the divergent parts are. So d4q, 2 pi to the 4th, then pi squared over q squared minus m squared. Well, okay, you've got a denominator that goes like 2 to the 4th. If you just look at, we're going to think of this in spherical coordinates. Four-dimensional spherical coordinates. So we've got a three sphere and we've got a radius. Look at the radial integral. D cubed 4 has an r to the fourth dr, an r cubed dr, right? So four-dimensional spherical coordinates, we can go through this one. You're going to get an r cubed dr instead of an r squared dr in the volume element. So there's a cube here, you've got a q to the fourth down here, so you're going to end up with dq over 2, which is a logarithmic divergence. That's what we expect here. So let's hit it rigorously. This is just the magnitude of that. We have to worry a little bit about this pole. We've studied this in the complex plane before, so we want to complexify. Q. Let's see, is it all of Q is 0, the 0 component. That would be good. So what happens is we're going to let Q 0 be Q 0 real plus Q of I times Q 0 imaginary. And remember what the situation was, and remember that we do have a plus I epsilon here, so that shifted the poles to this point. So this is Q equal to essentially M, what is it, it's square root Q 0 is the square root of Q vector squared plus m squared Is it plus I epsilon? And that turns out to shift this down. And then this is going to be where Q0 is equal to the other root. So, but yeah, this ends up being that magnitude minus I epsilon, and this is root Q squared plus M squared plus I epsilon. You remember we did that. We integrated closing in the lower half plane or closing in the upper half plane, depending on the time ordering. Okay. So, remember our contour. We were integrating up the real axis and then closing in the lower half plane. And something about contour integrals, you can deform the contour. All right, so for contour integrals, we have the residue theorem, which says that the integral around any contour of some CBZ is 2 pi I times the residue of F of Z. At simple poles, inside C. And so, you know, if you've got a pole here and any contour C where you integrate around that, and you know, this is some 1 over Z minus Z naught times some F tilde, where F tilde is regular everywhere, but you have a simple pole, a 1 over x type pole at, you know, this point, z naught. Then any curve that encloses that gives the same integral. And you can easily show you deform this or you add a closed loop that contains no poles, and you get no contribution to these complex integrals. And, you know, these are fun theorems to prove, and, you know, still read the complex analysis book if you haven't seen this stuff, because it's cool. It's really slick stuff. Right, the point is, you know, we can move this contour around any way we like, we're going to get the same value for the integral, as long as we don't let the contour cross a pole. So, look at this contour. This is fine. We can distort this contour and, start bringing it around up like this. In fact, what I want to do is shift it around this way, rotate the whole thing 90 degrees counterclockwise. Haven't crossed any poles. So we're going to rotate the contour 90 degrees counterclockwise. This is called a wake rotation. You start to get the feeling that Wick had something to do with quantum field theory. So the Wick rotation brings you around, so now this integral, remember when the magnitude of Q is large, this integrand is dropping off, so we're still getting no contribution out here. But now we're going to integrate up and down the imaginary axis. So dQ0 is dq real 0 plus I dq imaginary 0. And we're going to be integrating along that axis. We pick up a factor of I, and we integrate the coefficients of the imaginary part. Then what happens to q squared minus m squared is that we have q 0 squared minus q vector squared minus m squared. But this thing is really q, in the complex extension. This is Q plus I, Q imaginary, not quantity squared. And we're entirely now in the Q sub I realm, so we're going to pick up a sign in this denominator. So Q squared minus M squared on the imaginary axis is going to be minus quantity qi naught squared plus q vector squared. It becomes Euclidean.
Does this sound a little familiar?
It's squared, so that overall sign is going to go away, but we have the net effect that it's a sum of terms here, so we're in Euclidean Bohr space. And yeah, right. Which rotation? All right, he only rotated one dimension. Do this in eight dimensions where you complexify all four. That's a biconformal space. So you get all these structures in space and a unique prescription for going to the Euclidean realm in the biconformal picture. I think, you know, there's lots to be proved about all that.
Question.
Yes.
When you complexify this, is Q0 squared the same as the complex one squared? Or how are we doing this?
Yeah, this is just a number squared here. That's just one component of the vector. There are the other three. So now we've made that one component into a complex number. So we just square the complex number. And if we were going off along some curve here where, you know, we have to do both the dr and the dqr and dqi part, you know, it's a line integral that we're doing here. So you might be integrating both of those, but actually we're just going to integrate up the imaginary axis. So actually, on that curve, dqr is zero. But this is just square that number. It's not taking the norm. It's squaring it.
Okay, but when you find the norm of the complex one, is it the same as squaring the real one? Yeah, that's my question.
There is a complex norm on these numbers.
Right, right.
But we're not using it. What we're doing is analytically continuing this thing. And what that means is you replace a real variable by a complex variable and just do whatever algebra is indicated by the real function. So that is just square that thing. So the square of that is not real. You know, you've got imaginary cross terms and stuff. So it's not Q2R, it's Q2.
Right, but I'm trying to think why we can do this in the first place, you know. Are we thinking about this in different directions then or something? Or?
Okay, this plane replaces one, this is a time axis in an space here.
Oh, I see. Okay, so we're making a vector. We're just adding i's to the three components of the vector.
Yeah, so we're taking one component of the four vector and complexifying, doing the analytic continuation of just the time component.
Okay.
Everybody else good? Okay. Then, let's see. We can try and do this integral stuff. Let's see. What have we got? Okay, so let's see. So now A at t equals 0 minus I m the square root over 2. Then we have, all right, we're going to write this as Q is a four vector. 0, Q now the imaginary part and the three vector part. And D4Q can be written in, all right, it's a Euclidean space. It's a four-dimensional Euclidean space now. for the purposes of the integral of the imaginary act. And we can write that in spherical coordinates just like we do in three dimensions. We'll look at a little bit of three-dimensional geometry and figure out the angular integral. But I claim I can write d4q as a radial part with an r cubed and integrals over three angles. I'm claiming it'll look like that. We'll take a peek at it in a bit. But certainly something like r to the fourth is dimensionally correct. So that's what we're going to have. We're going to have an r cubed dr, and then we have a three-dimensional set of angular integrals. What else? There's probably a 2 pi to the 4 floating around. And then what we have here, let's see, we're going to have actually I cubed, because remember we picked up an extra I from the, where did it go, from here, because we're doing the imaginary part. Then we have a denominator, the denominator here is r squared plus m squared squared. So what I'm saying is r squared is qi0 squared plus q x squared. That thing, that's the magnitude now in Euclidean space after the Weak limitation. And angles, well, let's take a look at how we define angles in a higher dimension. Okay, this is bound to be a little confusing, right? So let's think of a row hat where we have an angle phi. And we know that we can write row hat as I hat cos phi plus J hat sine phi. And if we go to three dimensions, what happens? Well, you know, now what we do to write this, let's call this one n hat in three dimensions, what we're going to do is rotate between k hat, so we're going to take k hat times cosine theta, and we're going to take rho hat times sine theta, and that's going to be a unit vector off at some angle theta like this. And we can substitute in. So rho hat is just this stuff, so we're going to have I hat cos phi sine theta. And we're going to have J hat sine theta and sine phi. And we're going to have K hat cos theta. And many of you have seen that before. Well, so how do we go to the next step? What we're going to do in four dimensions, we need another direction. Let's call it capital M hat is going to be, we need an L hat and a cosine of some new angle chi plus N hat times the sine of chi. So we're going to take this unit vector in the three-dimensional direction and do something that rotates between that and some fourth direction L hat. This is a sine and cosine rotation.
Where is K hat in this first picture?
Oh, K hat is the...
Oh, okay.
You know, just I hat, J hat, K hat.
Right, okay. Right.
And then L hat is that way. Perpendicular. We get L hat cos psi plus, all right, so now what? We're going to have I hat sine chi sine theta cos phi plus J hat sine chi
sine theta sine phi plus k hat sine chi cos theta.
And, hey, check, that's a unit vector.
Right.
Sum the squares of the coefficients there, because those are all orthonormal unit vectors. And, okay, so we're going to have a cosine squared. If you take the sum of squares of these two, the sine phi and cos phi squared give one. So you just end up with sine squared chi sine squared theta. This one, you end up with sine squared chi cos squared theta, so the cos squared and sine squared now give you one. So all of this squares to sine squared chi, plus cos squared chi is one. It's a unit vector. Okay, so emboldened by that, let's see if we can come up with something like, you know, what is z rho hat? All right, notice that rho hat dot rho hat is 1, so rho hat dot d rho hat is going to be half of d of that, which is 0. So d rho is going to be perpendicular to rho hat, and that's an angular direction, so we can get differentials in the angular directions here. If I just take d of this, I have minus I hat sine phi plus j hat cosine phi d phi. Well, that's cool. If I square that, that vector squares to 1 and I get d phi squared. So, that is up to the radius, right? That is the contribution of the angular vector to the line element. So in two dimensions, we have dr squared plus r squared d rho dot d rho. D rho, remember, is an angular variable. It's just going to be dr squared plus r squared d phi squared. That's our line element, right? We can read the two-dimensional metric off of that in the cylindrical coordinates. And from the metric, we can get the volume element from the determinant. You guys remember general relativity? That was a year ago or year and a half ago, right? We did some of that. Okay, so let's see what happens in two dimensions. Three dimensions. Does this keep working?
Why is d rho 0 again?
D rho. D of rho squared. Where?
Right there.
Rho dot.
Oh, dot. Oh, yeah.
D rho is okay. Orthogonal. Since it's a unit vector, it can only change perpendicular to itself.
Okay.
So now if we look at D n hat, that's going to be, well, we've got n hat down here. So we have I hat, sine phi sine theta plus J hat cos phi sine theta d phi plus, and now if I do the d theta part, I'm going to have I hat sine phi cos theta d theta plus J hat cos phi cos theta this would be cos theta and sine phi, and then the K hat is going to be minus K hat sine theta all times d theta. And so if I square the end, I expect my line element to be dr squared plus r squared dn dot dn. So let's see if that works. So we have our dr squared, and then we have r squared. And now, let's see. If I dot this into that, we get an overall cosine theta, sine theta, but then we have sine cos with a minus sign, and here we have cosine with a plus sign, so that's orthogonal to that. So these two pieces are orthogonal, and we just need to sum their squares. So the square of the phi piece is going to be sine squared phi sine squared theta plus cos squared phi sine squared theta. That's sine squared theta. So I'm going to have a sine squared theta d phi squared from the dot product of this piece with itself. The dot product of this with that is zero. And then we have the square of all this stuff. Okay, so I'm going to have cos squared phi cos squared theta plus cos squared theta sine squared phi plus sine squared theta all d theta squared. Close parameter. Alright, now these two give me just cosine squared. Cosine squared plus sine squared is 1. So I just get the usual line element, dr squared plus r squared. Then we have a d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. Jeff's over there grumbling. What's all this got to do with math? It ends up having to do with that. It's really funky. Okay, so we've got a systematic way to develop line elements and volume elements. So let's just do the M. What happens? Well, it's not so serious. We just we get a sine squared chi on all of this and a d chi squared. But let's just work it out. dm hat is equal to, did I do all this length? It don't work out. I thought I did it like down in the corner of a page. How did that happen? Okay. I see. Do this one. Alright, so dm is L hat minus L hat sine chi d chi plus n hat cos chi d chi plus sine chi d n hat. And the n is orthogonal to both L and N hat. It's orthogonal for L because L goes off in that direction we can't even draw, and it's orthogonal to N hat because N hat being a vector, just like before. So we know what dn is. We know what dn dot dn is. So we can write dm dot dm as, okay, all of this dotted into itself, and these three are mutually perpendicular. So the sum of squares of these two is going to give us a d chi squared. The sum of the square of that is a sine squared chi times this element right here, times the stuff we had before, d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. And then we just need to write the line element in four Euclidean dimensions in spherical coordinates. We have the r squared plus r squared quantity d chi squared plus sine squared chi d theta squared plus sine squared chi sine squared theta d phi squared. There's our line element, and we can read the metric off in spherical coordinates. Yeah, cool geometry. Let's see, we're integrating that up there, so I think I can erase over here. Do isn't very believable. How you guys doing? You with me?
Do we have another car?
Where?
Never mind.
Oh, no, this is the square distance. The determinant in one higher dimension will give us an extra R, though. So the metric is just a set of coefficients of the coordinate differentials in that expression. It's diagonal. And its determinant, what we really want is the square root of the determinant of the metric is, all right, that determinant of G, alpha, beta. Okay, what is it? It's, we have a 1, we have 3 factors of R squared. So we're going to pick up an R to the 6th. Then we get a sine squared chi, actually twice. So we're going to have sine 4 chi and sine squared theta. Is that right? So we take the derivative of that, or the square root of that, and sine squared chi sine theta. So d cubed omega, or let's say d4x in 4 dimensions, Euclidean, is equal to r cubed dr, sine squared chi d chi, sine theta, and d phi. There's your 4-dimensional volume element in Euclidean. In circles.
So where do we get the 6 from again? I'm not quite seeing.
Okay. 1, this r squared is multiplying everything.
Right.
So you get an r squared, 1 from each.
Right. Okay. All right, we'll put it together. Okay.
Any other questions, though? There are often better ways of dealing with high dimensional spaces than explicitly writing angular chords. You can come up with some nice orthogonal units for the normal spaces. I guess a solder form. No, you can write a solder form in arbitrarily high numbers of dimensions fairly easily. It's not too bad. So there are other ways to go than this if you really have to deal with spheres in high dimensions. Okay, actually in my dissertation, I had to do that. I was doing black holes in n dimensions in extended gravity. And I had to write the solder form in spherical coordinates because I had spherical symmetry. There's one expression that works in every dimension. It's a little algebraic. It's got a square root in it and stuff. It's not just totally pretty, but it's one simple expression. So if you have to go to higher dimensional spherical symmetry, use the orthonormal frame field. It'll be easier. Okay, so if we integrate this thing over the angles, let's get back to our integral. I hope you didn't mind the digression. I thought that might be kind of fun. Let's see, we've got minus I lambda squared over 3. Then a bunch of R stuff. We've got there's this I cubed, don't pull that out. Then, R cubed dr, we have r squared plus m squared, quantity squared. Somewhere there's a 2 pi to the 4th, so let's make this 2 times 2 pi to the 4th. And then we have the angular integral, d cubed omega. And so let's evaluate d cubed omega is equal to the integral 0 to pi, sine theta d theta, everything else runs 0 to 2 pi, 2 pi d phi, 0 to 2 pi, sine squared chi d chi. So we just do those integrals. The phi gives us the 2 pi. This is d of cos theta from minus 1 to 1, so we get a 2 from this one. And then for sine squared, we can write that as the integral 0 to 2 pi. And then sine squared you can write as half of sine squared pi plus 1 minus cos squared pi. And you recognize that sine squared minus cos squared is a double angle formula. So, integral d cubed omega is 4 pi. 4 pi, there's the usual surface of the sphere. 4 pi radians. And then we have a half integral 0 to 2 pi. Then we have a 1 minus cos 2 pi. Chi. And that gives us chi. Alright, this is minus 1 half sine 2 chi. Just the derivative of that, we get, we pull down a 2 and get a cosine, so minus 2 cosine. So 0 to 2 pi just gives us 2 pi. So we end up with, wait a minute. I'm thinking chi should run 0 to pi. No, that's hard to figure out. Let's see, the first one gets to go all the way around. The next one,
only 0, 1 goes 0.
Yeah, so these only go that far. So we get pi here. So pi over 2. Times all this other stuff. So the net result is 2 pi squared. The surface area of a unit free sphere in 4 dimensions. That's right. I think that's right. Let's see. There's this. Okay, this whole two boards, he says, the factor 2 pi squared is the solid angle in 4 dimensions. Okay, I get it. Okay, so now, I think he's dropping the mass. We dropped P. We might, P is bigger than M, so we should be dropping M too. So, in that approximation, so large R, so that's much less than R. So, A, 0, let's take it to a large value in the upper limit. So we have minus I lambda squared. Then we have 2 over 2 pi to the fourth. We have our 2 pi squared from the angular integral here. And then we have the integral up to some cutoff, dr over r, because the r to the fourth here cancels with the r cubed and leaves us with the logarithmic divergence. So what we have is minus I lambda squared. Let's see, this is 16 pi squared. I may have lost a factor of two somewhere. Log
to the fourth.
Lambda. What's that? Okay. Plus finite stuff.
Oh, never mind.
So at the lower limit, you're going to get something that you can compute exactly. But the divergence part, all right, this lambda, you know, is supposed to go off to infinity, and that's the divergence bit. So we've identified the part that's going off to infinity. And we can actually, in some cases, we can incorporate that into our formula for the propagator. That lambda comes into the propagator in a fairly simple way. So that's the next thing I want to do. Let me see if I can... Yeah, this is another calculation. This is a tadpole graph. So let's take a break and let you guys have questions. Nathan, you haven't had questions for days.
I know, seriously, I don't know.
It is, and you've always had like three.
Right.
How's it going?
Yeah.
Good. You're nodding your head. That's good. Anybody else? Yeah.
So
what you got?
The finite stuff comes from the stuff that we set to zero, m squared and p squared.
Yeah. We've gone to the extreme high lambda limit here, but you know we have a lower limit. You know that runs from zero. And all right, we've got this m squared sitting here that keeps it finite at the origin, so we're okay there. So it's going to have some finite contribution there. But yeah, putting in the p and the m and taking that lower limit gives us the finite. Anything else? Yeah.
If we take the lower limit, we have negative infinity in the first term, right?
Where? The R interval runs from zero to infinity.
Right, if we put zero into log of...
Yeah, but you're not allowed to throw M out if you're going down to zero.
Okay.
So, you know, this is laying nicely Euclidean, you've got a plus M squared here, so you've got a built-in cutoff there.
Okay.
What is a lambda parameter?
Lambda is called a cutoff. All right, really this is infinity up here, but we're going to stop integrating at some number lambda.
Okay.
Yeah, we've got units of r, I guess, or let's see. Well, we're really in momentum space. It's got units of momentum.
Okay.
But yeah, it's something that really at the end of the calculation we'd like to let it go to infinity, but. We can't quite do that until the very end. You know, we'll develop some techniques to handle it because it comes in. If we put lambda into the formulas we've developed so far, it's still there. It doesn't go away. But by the time you calculate a scattering cross section, the probability for scattering through an angle theta, you know, in some particular reaction. And you do some sort of regularization, some way of either canceling off or systematically subtracting off or otherwise eliminating the infinite quantity, you know, then you get a finite prediction. It's tricky because let's see, this lambda, well, the tadpole graphs that I want to do are going to, you can sum them all up, and what you get is you can replace the propagator by, instead of m squared in the propagator, you'll have m squared plus lambda squared in the propagator. It's like it's changing the mass, but changing the mass by an infinite amount. This is where renormalization comes in. What you do is you say, oh, well, the mass in that formula is really some negative infinite thing, such that when I add this other infinite thing to it, what I get is the measured mass. So the combination of all of these, of the whatever mass was originally there, plus all these corrections that are going to infinity, gives you something you just boldly replace by m squared, the measured mass squared. So that's the renormalized mass. Then the one that you added all those infinities to is called the bare mass. And you assume there are all these corrections to the bare mass that gives you the measured value. Well, that doesn't feel really great, but it works. That's the simplest thing that works is if you have enough parameters like masses and charges in your theory, you can use each one to absorb some infinity, and it turns out in a renormalizable theory that you can just absorb the infinities into your constants, replace them by the measured constants like the charge of the electron and the mass of the electron in QED, and you're good to go. You've gotten rid of all the infinities because all of them show up in the same way. They all show up as that same correction to M or E, which is somewhat magical in itself. Well, there does exist a quantum field theory that is not ultraviolet divergence, where these divergences don't occur. It's N equal 4 conformal supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. Turns out to be a finite quantum field theory. It is not ultraviolet divergence. It's not a local conformal symmetry. There's a global conformal symmetry to the action, and it's supersymmetric and has 4 different distinct supersymmetries. What happens in supersymmetric models in general is you get cancellations. You'll get some other contribution to the amplitude from the supersymmetric partner to this particle that exactly cancels this nasty term. And, you know, that's great. There's a very exciting thing about supersymmetry that, before taking 7390 or whatever this course is, nobody understands. You've got to see these things emerge before you can really appreciate a theory where they go away. But that's just the nature of stuff. How are you holding? You want to see some tadpole graphs and some accents? You could, or is it Friday afternoon? You want to get out of here? I mean, tell me. I'm good to go for some tadpoles.
You turned to frogs.
They sort of. Yeah, although you need an infinite series of them, and they only turn into one frog.
Oh, okay.
But other than that, no, that's kind of I qualified on the frog issue. All right. Have you got both boards?
I think so. Yeah, I have this one.
Okay. Let me start the tadpoles off on the left. The tadpole graph works best in phi 4 theory.
I got it.
Lambda phi 4. So let's look at that theory and look at some simple graphs. Just a particle in and a particle out.
Before you erase this other side,
Yeah. Do
we have an expression for the finite stuff that's left over?
We did not keep enough terms. We threw out the terms that contribute to it. Remember, there was a P we threw out here that would have been down there too, and the M squared. So,
but we'd have the same coefficient.
Yeah, the rest would be the same, except that, see, the thing is, if you have the P squared down here, and what you really have is Q plus P squared minus M. And what you're going to get when you square this is a four-dimensional product, remember. So you're going to have Q squared, and you're going to have P squared, but then you're going to have Q0, P0, minus Q vector dot P vector. That contains angles. So when we do these angular integrations, it's not just going to be 2 pi squared in the lower parts of this. And you can handle some of these things analytically. Sometimes you don't have to do that integral because you're you're trying to get a differential cross section as a function of angle, so you don't integrate over all the angles, you just leave it as a function of angle. Various things can happen, but it gets hard. You know, at some point you actually aren't just integrating over a bunch of delta functions, and some of these integrals get grueling to the point of months of supercomputer time to really handle higher order perturbation theories. But at the order we've been looking at, many interesting problems allow you to actually do the integrals. You can actually compute them exactly and get a nice close expression for the quantum field theory corrections. To say the Coulomb law, right? You know, you've got, say, an electron positron scattering. Well, the force between them is Coulomb's law at lowest order in perturbation theory. And you can derive that from quantum field theory, which is Coulomb in itself. And you get the Rutherford scattering cross-section if you calculate the differential cross-section to lowest order in quantum field theory. Now you add some corrections, and you get the Klein-Machina formula, which is a correction to the Rutherford scattering formula, and this is the correct scattering for a pair of charged particles. So, you know, you carry things right. So, in answer to your question, well, it's not so simple.
Thank you.
Okay. Another question before I write?
Jeff, you did it?
Yeah, I think so.
So, yeah, I've done this whole integral with the assumption that we're just looking at the upper range of the variables, and yeah, there's more to be done if you want the finite part.
What is the chi part that goes from 0 to 5 there?
That's the fourth angle, right? We're in four dimensions.
So that's complex angle between the vector and time.
It's a real angle between the imaginary time component of the momentum in momentum space. So remember, we have a D4Q, we're in momentum space. And the time component of that has been complexified. So Q0 now becomes a complex variable, and we shift the integration to the imaginary,
and that's where we
Q0 axis. But the angle between that axis and the other three spatial axes, are now ordinary real angles. That axis with the other three spatial directions is a Euclidean space, because we've got an extra I going there in Q squared. Okay. So we get an extra angle. We're in four dimensions, right? We're in four dimensions, and if we were doing the relativistic thing, that'd probably be a finch or something. Right, we'd have some hyperbolic functions in the line element if we were staying in the space-time picture, not complexifying the time component momentum.
So, is the time component pure imaginary? Time component.
The integration is along the pure imaginary part of the time component.
Okay.
Now, the time component has become the complex plane, right? It's a variable that used to be a real variable, but now we're allowing it to be an arbitrary complex variable, and then we specify a curve.
Okay.
So there were questions. Good. Questions are good. Okay, so tensile graph. So we have lambda phi 4. So our interaction Hamiltonian has this piece in it. And what that means is if we have a momentum coming in, we can have an interaction that does a little loop thing and goes out. And now we're going to have an integration over the amount of momentum that goes around in that loop. This is called a tadpole graph. Well, they look more like tadpoles maybe if you draw them like, tadpoles. Doesn't look like it.
At the head, yeah. There's a pole, yeah.
All right. Yeah, that's a cat in there. So how do we compute this thing? N^5 So, let's see, what happens? Okay. So, if we go to the let's jump right to the relevant integral. So this introduces integral d4k over 2 pi to the 4th. And the propagator, let's see, the propagator on the internal line, right? So, let's see, what is this? This is some momentum k that's, let's see, not determined by anything. So the propagator is, I think, just going to be 1 over k squared. It's just the one internal line. Is that right? Oh, plus m squared. Yeah, that's right. And then we have a minus 5 end over 2. So k squared plus or minus. Oh, after the Wick rotation. Alright, so let's think about the Wick rotation on our own. So we start off with the k squared minus m squared. We have minus I lambda over 2 out here. And let's call this thing I times B, I think, or is it plus or minus B? He chooses it with a little bit of hindsight to be a minus I times B. And the so the integration then becomes Euclidean, and we just have to integrate that thing. And we can integrate that thing exactly. So how do we do that? This is going to be lambda over 2, 2 pi to the 4th. And then, what are we going to have? Well, once again, we want r cubed dr d3 omega. So, yeah, we're going to do the same thing here. We're going to let k not be extended to a complex variable, just the one component. And then we're going to do a Wick rotation, so we're integrating up the imaginary time axis, and this becomes, a variable, up the imaginary axis. This becomes Euclid. Looks like there's an overall sign this time. So what we're going to have is ki squared gives us just k, no, just r squared plus m squared. There. So that's the integral we need. I think I got the sign right, because when you square that I here, you have an overall minus sign that you need to pull out. So minus lambda over twice 2 pi to the 4th integral, and then we're going to go up to lambda again. Let's see, 0 to lambda, I think we can do the whole thing this time. But let's write this as r squared and then d of r squared over 2 is r dr. So that's the same as this numerator part. This volume element gives us, what do we say, 2 pi squared for the volume, the 3 volume. And then we have r squared plus m squared. So we can just let x equal r squared plus m squared. So minus ib is equal to minus 2 pi squared lambda over twice 2 pi to the 4th. The numbers. Then, let's see, r squared is going to be x minus m squared dx over x. And x runs from m squared now to some cutoff lambda. Let's call this one lambda prime, so that one should be lambda. And that we can just integrate. So we just get minus pi squared lambda over 2 pi to the 4th. Simplify that. Then what? X over x is 1, so we just get an x, so we get a lambda minus. Be careful. R goes up to lambda squared. So when we get just an x here, that's a lambda squared. Lower limit minus m squared. An m squared times the x over x is a log, and that'll be lambda squared over m squared. So there we get.
I probably shouldn't have changed my lambda.
If I hadn't changed my lambda, I wouldn't have had this extra m squared here. So let's not. This lambda, this becomes, when r is lambda, this is lambda plus squared plus m squared. So I get lambda squared plus m squared minus m squared. It's just a plain lambda squared, so it's simpler if I just leave it alone. So there's the divergent part of a tadpole diagram. Well, that's ugly. But let's
press on and see what it does.
You're missing m squared in the log. If you want to go from x minus m squared, like lambda squared plus m squared over.
Oh, right. Which is indeed there. Okay, so this is minus 5b. Did I get the right number of factors and stuff in? Is this coefficient right? So this is minus lambda over 15 pi squared.
Oh, it's got 32. I lost an I and a 2. Why?
There's a 2 here. So that's a 4. So we still have a 2 here. So that's a 32. And where'd the I go?
Minus I lambda.
Oh, is I already out? The I next to the lambda, is that the one that goes with the...
Oh, he has a minus I lambda. Oh, I see.
When he defines this thing, this is already in the Euclidean case. So it's not here, and when we go Euclidean, we get it. So that's the difference. Okay. So now we agree. So we have an I here. There we go. All right. So now, this is the only tadpole graph at order 1 in lambda, but, if you go to order 2 in lambda, well, order lambda squared, let's see what we can do. Well, you can put in a tadpole, and you can put in another tadpole. That's cool. Let's see. There's probably other stuff we can do, though.
Can you put, like, tadpoles on tadpoles?
What's that?
You can't put tadpoles on tadpoles right now.
Well, yeah. You could put tadpoles on tadpoles, right, at higher levels. that's the problem. You have this, but you also have a tadpole on a tadpole. Nothing wrong with that.
Okay.
And there are probably much worse things you can do. So this summation that he does is cute, but it really doesn't account for all the diagrams. This is typical in quantum field theories. You find some subset of the possible diagrams that you can actually sum all of them. And there's no harm in doing it, but you haven't solved the whole problem to that order. What you get is, if you have multiple TAD holes, multi-TAD, you've got, a bunch of these things. What you're going to get here is, you have a propagator for each little stretch here, so you're going to have a d tilde of p in the expression. Each tadpole is going to give you this minus I b thing, and you just keep sticking those in. So order by order, let's call them linear tadpoles or something. As opposed to quadratic tadpoles or whatever that would be. I don't know what that would do. But the scattering matrix we're going to get is going to be something like... we have a d tilde of p where it just propagates. And then if we have one tadpole, we have the propagator coming in, and then we have a minus IB, this thing we just computed, and then we have a d tilde p. And we're going to do this to all orders. So if we want to pick in another d tilde p minus IB, d tilde p, and so on. And we can rank that as a power series. If we pull out one of the D's, then the rest is the sum, n equals 0 to infinity, of just powers of minus IPD. IB times D tilde of T n times. And we know what that sum is. That's just what kind of series is that? Geometric? Just the sum of powers, right? The sum x to the n is just 1 over 1 minus x. So this is equal to 1 over, so we have a propagator, and a 1 over 1 minus this, but it's got a minus in it, so plus I, B, D, over P, which doesn't seem all that bad. So let's see. What happens is that we end up, we write that propagator. So the effective propagator is going to be, what is this? 1 or I over c squared minus m squared, 1 over 1 plus ib over I over c squared minus m squared, which we ought to be able to simplify. That's I over c squared minus m squared minus c, which is why the I was stuck on the b in the first place. Notice that we write this as minus m squared plus b, and we've given a correction to the math, albeit infinite. So that's, as I say, that's cute. If you go to next order, you can also have stuff like, breaking into three. And this gives you something that's a truly nasty integral.
We don't need to figure out the square over six. But there are two unknown momenta here. Let's call them K1 and K2. So we have two of those, and this is going to be T minus K1 minus K2, I guess. So they conserve overall momentum. So you can stick something like this in. This is now, okay, yeah, that was 5-4, but yeah, this is the order of magnitude squared in 5-4 theory. So besides, like, double pads and stuff, we've got stuff like this with two angles. So we have a D4K 2, 2 pi to the 4th. And we have a D4K 1 over 2 pi to the 4th. And then a pair of propagators I over, and then, let's see, it's these guys, but which one? Hang on. There are three. You get all three propagators. Yeah. So T minus K1 minus K2 squared minus M squared times I over K1 squared minus M squared times I over K2 squared minus M squared. And that's a truly bleak integral to contemplate. That you get all these cross products between the P and the K1 and the K2 when you square out that first propagator. And now you have to integrate over K1 and K2. Well, you know, calculating what the divergent part looks like, where you can neglect a lot of things, even then, you've got to worry about the angle between K1 and K2, the three momenta in the K1 and K2 directions. You're going to get some cosine stuff, which, you know, you can probably plug through. I mean, you know, this integral can be done. I don't know. Throw it on Maple, see what happens. I don't know if Maple will handle that kind of thing. An eightfold integral? Never try that. You guys get an eightfold?
A lot of parentheses.
I avoid those things. Anyway, this can be shown to lead to something like after considerable work, you can replace the propagator if you add up a bunch of these things. So if you have any arbitrary numbers of these things, you can resum the propagator again, and you end up with some factor, some function of lambda squared here, and probably depends on the mass. There's a depends on p squared. Yeah, p squared times p squared minus, and then you get what you get is m squared plus some function of lambda here, and you know that's fairly horrendous. So not terribly enlightening to try and work through details of all that. Those functions, what happens is there are a bunch of constants and stuff you get from the detailed integrations, but you don't know what they are unless you do the detailed integration. You know, you can always do integrals numerically if you really need to know the numbers, as long as there aren't too many. Of course, if you want to go to fifth or sixth order in perturbation theory, then you're going to have an awful lot of diagrams. You know, it goes up, I don't know, probably, it's hard to count topology. If you've ever taken a topology course and, you know, wondered how many topologies are there with n elements, well, it's possible it goes up faster than, let's see, could it go up faster than exponential? It's certainly, you know, something like X number of topologies of a given size is increasing exponentially, or it might even be end of the n. I forget. I'd have to think about it. But there are lots of different connected things. So, okay. Question. I think we finished this section. So next, what do we do next time? I think next time we start. I will start with a summary of the scalar field rules next time. That's right. This is exactly where I wanted to get to. Okay, so Monday I'll summarize all the Feynman rules for the scalar fields. Those aren't very interesting. So then that'll get us started looking at the Feynman rules for Dirac fields and gauge fields, vector fields. So once we have those Feynman rules, we're doing QED. You know, we can actually do some perturbation theory in QED. Also, Jeff, when do you think you might be able to talk about...
Wednesday, okay?
Sure. You want to do it Wednesday?
Yeah.
Okay.
I could probably try to do it on Monday.
Wednesday's fine. Yeah, there's no, it's a topic that is of interest. Okay, yeah, Jeff's been reading an article that talks about asymptotically convergent theories. So these theories aren't convergent, they're asymptotically convergent, meaning he's going to tell us what that means. So, you know, Wednesday or Friday is fine.
Okay.
You know, that'll we'll get started on the Dirac fields on Monday, and that'll be fun. And then, you know, a break will be, you know, so whichever day you like. Okay. Good. All right.